Okay, friends, our turn here. Sunday, 3 to 5, stand to reason. Greg Kokel, your host for 2 hours of careful thinking about the critical issues of life. That's ethics, values, religion, and you're welcome to participate. And I certainly appreciate you listening and joining in our conversation. 1-800-227-5278 is the number. And if you're in the 714 area code, 754-4150. Line's wide open here, and I'd like to get to calls quickly. Got a few things to start out with, but I'd love to talk with you today. 1-800-227-5278, and in the 714 area code, 754-4150. I just got back from Raleigh, North Carolina 2 days ago, and spent 3 days with a fantastic group of people. In fact, I talked about them last time I was with them last year, how it was an incredible time with about 60 different Christians, followers of Jesus Christ, talking about theology, philosophy, everything under the politics, the world of ideas, and these people were now I gave it away, didn't I? These people are articulate, intelligent, capable of trafficking in the world of ideas, and the oldest is 17 and the youngest is 14. Unbelievable group of young people. That was last year. I spent 4 days, 3 days with them in Raleigh, North Carolina, at North Carolina State University at their Worldview Camp. And not only do they have Worldview training, and I was one of the featured speakers, was featured for the 2 days that I was there doing the teaching, but they also have a mock legislature. So they sit right there in the Capitol in the legislative seats, under the dome. And they have committee meetings, and they pass laws, and they deal with the press because they have a mock press there too. And they listen to lobbyists, and many of the lobbyists who come in to argue about the bills that they are working on. And these are actual bills that have gone through the legislature in the past. Many of the lobbyists are real lobbyists that make their case. And these kids are wearing suits and ties, and asking questions and putting the challenge on. And then they have they vote on their bills and pass their bills, and they've got a governor who vetoes or signs it. It's just a great experience for these kids, and it's great for me to be able to interact with them because I could move at my own speed. I've said in the past I don't really care to talk. Well, I should back up and say be careful how I say this. I have said in the past that it's difficult for me to speak to high school students, okay? And the reason is it's like talking through a painting much of the time. I mean, they just sit there and they don't respond. I like adults who at least laugh at your jokes and they act like they understand what you're saying. And now, they tell me, people who work with youth, that the kids are getting it and they're laughing on the inside if they're just bored looking on the outside. And they're following what you say much of the time, even though they're not giving any clues to that effect. But by contrast, though, this group of high school kids was really phenomenal. And in fact, every time I go there, last year, this year, and they're going to have me come back in the future, I get new stories of what they're doing. Some are actually heavily involved in politics, campaigning door to door and managing campaign teams for local politicians. I'm talking 15 and 16-year-old kids managing teams. One young lady told me how there was a professor, she's from Michigan, professor from Michigan State University, was involved in a debate on the issue of embryonic stem cell research. Now, I don't remember all the background information, except for there was this debate, and they had the professor, but they didn't have anyone to oppose him. And they poked around trying to find somebody that can take up the job, and finally, after not being able to find anybody right away, she just simply said, "I'll do it." And she had given a talk on embryonic stem cell research in the past. She had downloaded a lot of our material from Stand to Reason's website at str.org and did a great paper and presentation on her own. So when this chance came up, she said, "Okay, I'll do it." It was the professor from Michigan State University, the PhD, and the 14-year-old. Can you imagine that? And she did a great job. She wasn't afraid of this guy. She didn't need to be. She had the truth. She had a strategy. She had tactics. She knew how to maneuver. She had good training. And so she did a great job. These are the kind of people I just spent 2 or 3 days with. It was really sensational. a sensational experience once again. And it does bring to the, I guess, bring to the table discussion about the nature of homeschooling. And this has taken on a lot of momentum here in the last few years. More and more Christians are homeschooling their kids. Most of these kids were homeschooled kids. In fact, just about all of them were. And if they weren't homeschool kids, they were struggling to keep up with these kids, I guarantee you that. And there's a piece in World Magazine this month in June 5th issue by Joe Belts entitled Public Divide, Southern Baptists are about to take up a crucial debate over Christian children in state schools. And apparently the SBC, Southern Baptist Convention, has put forth a resolution recommending that parents throughout their 16.3 million member denomination remove their children from what the resolution calls godless and anti-Christian public schools. Probably a fair characterization. Not being a martyr here, just observing. Godless, anti-Christian public schools. That about covers it. Doesn't mean that some public schools can't do a fairly decent job, but by and large, their point of view, their point of reference, their foundational perspective let's face it, it's just hostile to everything that we believe and that we hold to be true. They are pluralistic, they are postmodern, they are relativistic, they are multiculturalistic. They are promoting diversity, and you and I know what that means. Principally, homosexuality, one, and secondly, every other point of view is just as good as ours. There is no moral distinction, so it's companion to relativism. And so our kids get, let's face it, indoctrinated, not brainwashed. I don't think that's the right word to describe it, but certainly indoctrinated day after day after day. It's the air they breathe. And so we shouldn't be surprised when the values of the culture prevail, when that's what they're hearing most of the time. Of course, this resolution from the SBC has created a bit of a stir, and it probably won't pass, the article suggests. Even so, it puts something out on the table. They've thrown their gauntlet into the arena for this discussion. The proposal, the article says, co-authored by Texas attorney Bruce Short, says public schools like to claim neutrality on important issues, but in the end effectively oppose Christianity, produce an education that is godless. Quoting here from that piece, or from Bruce Short, just as it would be foolish for a warrior to give his arrows to his enemies, the proposed resolution argues bluntly, okay, this isn't the resolution, it is foolish for Christians to give their children to be trained in schools run by the enemies of God. Close quote. Remember, Proverbs talks about children like arrows in your quiver? Why would you give your arrows to someone else? By the way, it does raise a question. This encourages serious Christian parents to form essentially a mass exodus from the public school system. And if that were to be the case, the article here points out, the public school system would probably collapse. Mr. Pinckney, who was a co-author of this resolution, says, I think that would be one of the finest things that can happen for the United States. In other words, for the public school system to collapse. Now, I realize this creates consternation on the part of many people when they think about statements like that. It sounds so bizarre. It sounds so separatistic. Friends, I've seen what they've produced. And I realize that there are some people who obviously, as the article states, a substantial majority of Southern Baptists still enroll their kids in public schools. And tens of thousands of Southern Baptists are employed as teachers and administrators and counselors and coaches and staff in public schools. And many of those people see their work as critical Christian witness in a sometimes pagan setting. And those people rightly raise the concern. In other words, it's right to raise it. I'm not saying the concern carries. It's right to raise the concern. Well, what about the public school system? Should we simply abandon the public school system? Should we just let it ride? Should we just let it self-destruct? Shall we just let it go down? Let's get out of there. Abandon the Titanic. And what about being a good witness in that circumstance? And the article offers a thought that I had not considered before, because I think it's a fair question to raise. The article says that the Pinckney Short perspective that's reflected in this resolution, this recommendation, does not denigrate the faithfulness of those Christians who are working in state schools. It's really a totally different debate. One argument is about public witness. The other is about the education of our children. Did you hear that? One argument is about public witness. The second one is the education of our children. We can still be a public witness without sacrificing our children to the public school system, is the point he's making here. These are very different issues, he writes. I speak very often around the country on behalf of Christian schools and homeschool groups. Wherever I go, I try to make just two points. Pick a school that tells the truth, first point. Second point, pick a school that works. That's pretty good. Pick a school that tells the truth. Pick a school that works. Do you think that should be the bare minimum of a requirement of any place that you send your kids for an education? If you send them there for an education, they should get an education. The school should work. It should do what it was designed to do, first thing. Secondly, when they are giving that education, they got to tell the truth. Now, it's very hard to tell the truth when you believe a lie. Oh, you might be able to tell some of the truth. You could do the math and the history. Maybe you could do the history. There's all kinds of reconstructionism now going on. You can do the math and the history and the, you know, social studies and whatever else. What else do kids study in high school? Gym, whatever. You can still do that to a degree, because there are some truths that we all hold to. But the foundational things, the place where you put all the other things, the way it all fits together. What is man? Where did he come from? Where is he going? What is his purpose? What is the ultimate end of man? What does a good education look like in light of what man is? Well, you see, education can't be pursued in a fullest sense without really definitive answers to these questions, and the public school system has the wrong answers. That means they're building from a wrong foundation, and so some of the blocks further up might be sound, but the foundation itself is in a sorry state. So how can the public school system tell the truth in the most important matters? Pick a school that tells the truth. Pick a school that works. He continues, it's a sad conclusion to draw, but more and more obvious that public, state-sponsored education increasingly flunks both these simple tests. It lies to, or at least misleads, our children about the most important issues of life, and increasingly it fails to prepare our children for the marketplace in which they are called on to work. I don't know which failure is worse, he concludes, but I do know that Christian parents don't have to settle for either one. By challenging the good folks of the SBC at large to grapple with these issues, the Pinckney Short proposal will do our whole nation a great favor. So it ends Joe Belt's Public Divide. Southern Baptist about to take up a crucial debate over Christian children and state schools. Of course, it's not the SBC. It's a whole lot of folk that are convinced that it's better for their kids if they take the additional step and make the sacrifice and pay the personal price to make sure that their kids are told the truth and given an education that works. And usually that means homeschooling. And if you're afraid of pulling the only witnesses that you have or there are in the public schools, your kids out, and that means the whole public school system is going to go straight to hell, quite literally, then so be it. And here's why. Your obligation, our obligation as parents, is first to our own kids, not to the non-Christian kids. This is a training time for them, our kids, so that when they are trained in the foundational issues and they are told the truth and they are equipped with an education that works, then they can go out there and be change agents for the cause of Christ. They're not going to do that in first, second, third, fourth, fifth through eighth grade or even beyond that. They're learning. So who's going to teach them, you or somebody else who doesn't believe what you believe? We want these kids to be agents of change for the long haul, not to rescue some public school system while they're in grade school and junior high. They aren't going to do it. They don't know how. They need to be trained, and they're not going to get the training there. In fact, what may instead happen if we persist in sending our kids to public schools where we, for the reason of trying to redeem the public school system with our kids in it, you may, instead of securing the belief of the public school kids, you may succeed in securing the unbelief of your own child. I realize not every family is able to homeschool. By golly, we ought to make sure that whatever education our kids are getting, it works and they're being told the truth. All right? 1-800-227-5278. Actually, those lines are open, but if you'd like to call from the Orange County area code, 714 area code, the number 754-4150. We're going to go to break just a little bit early, and then I'll jump in with Joseph on Original Sin and Danny, follow-up question on Evidence for the Soul, and be taking your calls too here. 1-800-227-5278, right here on Stand to Reason.
Do you have an important decision to make in your life? Are you looking for God's guidance or leading before you move ahead with the decision you're currently faced with? Well, Greg's teaching on decision-making and the will of God, available on audio cassette or CD, takes you through the scriptures to provide the tools you need to make sound choices. After hearing Greg's teaching, you'll experience a deeper sense of relief and freedom in decision-making than you've ever known before. You'll understand how reading scripture carefully makes a difference in many different issues, including making decisions. Decision-Making and the Will of God is available today from Stand to Reason in audio cassette or CD format. Extensive notes are included to help you with your study. Simply go to www.str.org or call the office at 800-2-REASON and order Decision-Making and the Will of God today. You'll be glad you did.
Hi, friends. This is Scott Klusendorf, and every year in the United States, there are over 1.4 million abortions performed. If you're ready to defend the unborn, then I want to enroll you in a class taught by Greg Kokel and me. Stand to Reason's interactive Making Abortion Unthinkable will prepare you to enter any pro-life arena, from one-on-one discussions to a public debate, with full confidence that your case is solid and your appeal is just. From the comfort of your own home or church, this easy-to-follow, well-reasoned plug-and-play course gives you everything you need to train yourself or a group in the art of pro-life persuasion. Through videotapes, workbooks, role-playing, quizzes, and games, Making Abortion Unthinkable will give you the tools you need to, one, restore meaning to the word abortion through the use of graphic visual aids, two, it will help you simplify the abortion issue by focusing on one strategic question, thirdly, it's going to give you the scientific evidence you need to make a sound, reasonable, and persuasive argument, and finally, you're going to be able to expose the four common flaws of pro-abortion rhetoric. If you're ready to take a stand against abortion, call Stand to Reason today at 800-2-REASON. That's 800-2-REASON, or visit us online at str.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, start your engines.
When you find yourself in danger, when you're threatened by a stranger, when it looks like you will take a licking, there is someone waiting who will hurry up and rescue you. Just call for Super Chicken. Fred, if you're afraid, you'll have to overlook it. Besides, you knew the job was dangerous when you took it. He will drink his super sauce and throw the bad guys for a loss, and he will bring them in alive and kicking. There is one thing you should learn, but there is no one else to turn to. Call for Super Chicken. Call for Super Chicken.
You know that last squawking chicken there, that bacank, that's actually me. I didn't sing that other song, but that's me. We got to tell the story one of these days about why the chicken stuff's on the show. Some people remember way back when with an individual caller. Anyway, we won't get into it right now because we've got callers. Let's go to Joseph here in South Carolina. Joseph, thanks for calling.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome, sir.
My question's on Original Sin.
Sure.
I'm trying to figure out, how does God, I understand that he cursed, maybe I understand that he cursed mankind because of the fall of Adam. But
right.
Yet, in Ezekiel chapter 18, he's refuting a false proverb. He calls a false proverb of the Israelites that right. their fathers have eaten their grapes and their children's teeth set on edge.
Yes, that's right.
Is this not the same issue in regards that humanity's teeth set on edge when Adam fell? I don't understand how
you're
held liable for what.
No, I understand. This is a hard one to describe, and I'll do my best to do it. This is Ezekiel. What passage is it? Ezekiel 18?
Yes, Ezekiel 18.
Okay, the Ezekiel 18 passage is a good one to read to refute the idea that the sins of the fathers are passed on to the children. And that's the particular thing that was being taken care of in Ezekiel 18.
Right.
There is a reference, of course, in starting in Exodus 20, I believe,
right.
During the Ten Commandments, where there's these references to the sins of the fathers. I think there's a tremendous amount of confusion on that and misapplication. In fact, whole ministries are built up around that. Neil Anderson's ministry, for example, is built on, I think, a totally mistaken understanding of that. And I think Ezekiel 18 speaks to that mistaken understanding, which is if the father commits a sin, the children will not be punished for the father's sin.
Right.
Okay. We still have to work out what's going on there in Genesis, Exodus 20. And then we also have to try to make sense of how this relates to this enterprise where we have original sin from Adam. And let me see if I can try to make sense of this, because these two concepts are very kin. And it does seem odd that one would be legitimate and one wouldn't be.
Okay.
It's clear, and orthodoxy dictates for us, especially from Romans 5, that we have inherited a sin nature,
right,
which makes us culpable with the race, okay?
Right.
Culpable with the race. For sin, and this is where you have what's called a federal headship circumstance, where God
right.
has an agreement with the human race, and at this time, initially, the human race is just Adam and Eve,
right.
And then He makes promises to them and their progeny, and then there is this fallout. Okay, well, the fallout is not just for Adam and Eve, but it's for the human race, which they represent, and which are to be produced through their loins. And
right.
so God's curse is upon the family, as it were, the group, of which there are only two representatives at this time. But there's
right.
something else that goes on. That is, it isn't just merely that there's a sense of guilt that is passed on to the next generation. Okay, your dad did something bad, so you're going to get punished for what your dad did. Okay, that isn't quite it. What happened in the fall is there was an ontological change in the nature of man.
Right.
Some accidental feature of the nature of man changed so that man's nature was now rebellious against God. Under God's wrath, and as a result, men are now. Human beings, because of this change, are rebels against God, under God's wrath, and slaves to Satan, etc. And so you've got in slaves to sin, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Every single person that is born afterwards, since Adam reproduces after his own kind, has those same qualities. So
right.
in a sense, it isn't that you and I are being punished for what Adam did. Straight up, Adam did this bad thing, we're going to punish the kid. It's that Adam's actions had consequence to all of his offspring. And
right.
one way of thinking about it, Joseph, may be to think about it like a genetic defect. Let's say your dad took drugs. He was a druggie during the 60s or something,
right.
you know. And the consequence of him taking drugs was that it was a mutagenic agent for his own body and his offspring, you.
Right.
We had to live with the consequence of that. And so maybe you had some kind of handicap that you didn't choose, but you still must suffer with the handicap.
Right.
In this particular case, the handicap is a moral one that's passed on. And so the children of Adam are, in fact, bent on evil. And so, and it's because of the moral defect that's passed on, not for the act of disobedience, that
right.
we are under God's judgment.
See, that's why I've had the difficulty understanding this is that, say, if my mother or father was on drugs while they were pregnant with me, and then I was born and I was addicted to drugs as a baby.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
I would have an addiction, but I would not be held morally responsible for what my father or my mother did. Well, I would deal with the physical ramifications, but not necessarily the moral or legal or anything. You could not take me to court and say, you know, you're guilty.
Sure.
How is it that, you know, it seems as though mankind now has not only we have the physical consequences like pain, suffering, but we also are held
morally accountable. Well, that's fair. And this is where I don't quite want to say that the analogy breaks down. It's just that the analogy isn't meant to be taken in that direction. The reason I use the drug thing is that because of the consequence of the behavior –
right.
And I'm not putting moral qualities on this behavior, the drug use, for the sake of this illustration. It's just that the behavior caused a change, which change is passed on with negative consequences to the children. And even though you're not blamed for it, you still suffer the liabilities of having the handicap as a result of this act of the parent.
I understand.
Okay. Now, in by parallel, the disruption of Adam was a moral disruption, not just a genetic disruption. And so it's the moral thing that's passed on. So we are actually born angry rebels, whatever. And that, in fact, we are responsible for because the thing that's being passed on is not just a handicap of a physical kind. It is a moral liability for which we are then responsible. And we are responsible as members of the family that is under judgment in virtue of the actions of the head of the family.
Okay, that's what I'm having difficulty understanding. Is our responsibility for such things? If we're not able to respond, if we're born incapable of
righteousness, we could not have done otherwise. And so, how is it that we are morally responsible for the actions?
Right.
This, I think, Joseph, is the most difficult theological problem to solve. I have no answer for it, except for this. Just for this. Your question is based on a very strong and persistent, and I think largely accurate, moral intuition that ought implies can.
Right.
If I could not have done otherwise, then how could I be held responsible?
Right.
And more my response to that is the intuition, at least in some regards, is not entirely sound. That is, it isn't always the case that ought implies can.
Right, and I'd even swayed a little towards believing almost in not so much of original sin. I'd studied
Pelagius.
It's called free will theism, and I haven't. Obviously, I'm more back towards almost a more Calvinistic view, but just in a while because I had so much a problem trying.
Yes, but free will theism doesn't solve this problem. Free will theism deals with another aspect of the problem. Free will theists, as far as I know, and I've listened to and talked to some of the foremost free will theists in the country, and they do not deny original sin. In fact, if they did deny original sin, then there would be first of all, that would be beyond the pale. That's Pelagianism for one, and secondly, then it seems to me they wouldn't. Well, I guess they'd still have some of the concerns that they face that they think free will theism will solve. But they want to maintain a real robust understanding of free will.
Right.
I meant open theism will solve. Right. They want to keep a robust understanding of free will, and therefore they think open theism is the only way to go about it. So I think that's false, and it's an abandonment of a very significant Orthodox position when you go that direction. But the problem is original sin, and open theism isn't going to solve that problem for you, you know.
Okay.
And nor is Arminianism going to solve it. I mean, this is a conundrum that we're faced with, and the only alternative theologically is to go outside of Orthodoxy and be like Pelagius, who just denied original sin.
Right. And see, I started reading some of Finney's work, and it just became very much unorthodoxic.
Finney's not the guy you want to follow theologically, in my view, you know. But you just think about this thing. You know, it does ought always imply can. And I think this is what we have to struggle with. Look, there are sacrifices that are given in the Old Testament for what's called presumptuous sins. That means sins committed in ignorance.
Right.
Well, if ought implied can, why would there have to be a sacrifice for sins committed in ignorance? There would be no guilt. But apparently there is guilt, and therefore a sacrifice is necessary.
Okay.
Keep in mind, by the way, that the comparison with Adam, the first Adam, is the second Adam. Jesus.
Right.
And so even though there is an inheritance of an old nature with the culpability that comes along with that,
right,
there is also in the new birth an inheritance of a new nature after our new father in the new birth, and all the good stuff that Jesus has comes along with that too, and that's ours. You know, so at least for the believer, there's a balancing out there.
Right, and where this also ties in for me is, you know, the idea of election. If a person believes in, obviously election is, the word election is used throughout the New Testament.
Yeah, election, it's the, how is election grounded would be the question. So if you're
right,
Calvinist.
Exactly.
Yeah, if you believe in unconditional election.
Right. How is it grounded, given, you know, the idea of original sin, the truth in original sin, how is election grounded if you believe some are chosen and some are not?
Well, it's grounded in the choice of God if you're a Calvinist, in the
right,
unconditional choice of God, where if you're an Arminian, it's grounded in your own personal choice that God knows in advance.
Right.
So, and that's what they mean by election, is God is electing those, some Arminians at least would characterize it this way, God is electing those who he knows will choose him. I think that guts the whole concept of election of any meaning,
right,
you know, because that's just turning election on its head. But in any event, this is one of the reasons that I'm Reformed or a Calvinist on this issue, because of I think the scripture is more directly points to this issue, but it does raise issues. By the way, the issue that you've raised is not solved by Arminianism, in my view, because the Arminian could say, well, then God cancels out cancels through prevenient grace. He kind of cancels out the impact of the sin in our lives, so we can come to a point of really making a free will decision, and then we have the choice to decide or not to decide. And if we don't decide, then it's our own problem. But my response is going to be, well, wait a minute. If we're not responsible for this in the first place, why should we even have to make a decision?
Right, exactly.
So I don't think that their position helps at all, ultimately, in answering the question that you've raised. I think the only answer is not Arminianism, but Pelagianism, and that's not open to any of us, it seems to me. So this is a tough one, Joseph, and, I've, struggled with it myself, and I've had this very conversation a couple of times in the last few months right on this program. And I just reminding people, some people may recognize this conversation, just it's just one of those things that's a struggle. It's difficult. And it's, this is where I think the revelation has got to go ahead of what seems to make the most sense with regards to our intuitions. And the revelation is quite clear on this issue, I think.
Right, I understand.
Joseph, I appreciate your call. I was just out in your neck of the woods, just the state north of you, just last week.
Okay.
So good people out there, and you're probably one of them.
When are you going to have the radio on out here?
The best I'll probably ever get to South Carolina is what you have already on the World Wide Web. So
okay.
I'm glad you listened.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Okay, thanks so much for the call, Joseph. 1-800-227-5278 is the number. Line is open there if you want to call in. You've been trying to get in, and the line's been busy. Now's your chance. And that is, ladies and gentlemen, like I said, the most difficult issue that I struggle with as a Christian myself. Does ought always imply can? If it does, then how are we culpable? If we are culpable for this in some sense for the sin of Adam, then maybe ought doesn't always imply can. So that's the hardship. Incidentally, he did mention Ezekiel 18, and maybe this will help for those of you who have thought about this particular issue. With regards to the sins of the Father, there is so much confusion about that, and I hear people citing sins of the Fathers all the time, apparently they haven't spent any time looking at the context. Now, I think this is a little bit of a difficult concept, particularly when we hear people talking about it all the time, and it seems like, well, our fathers did these things, so now we're affected and we do these things too, and that's what God is talking about in the passages that talk about sins of the fathers. You should go back to Exodus 20 and see that passage again. It says, God causes the sins of the fathers, or God visits the sins of the fathers onto the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate him. But mercy, kindness, whatever, to thousands of generation of those who love him. There are a lot of qualifiers in there, and there's a lot more information than most people quote that will help you. But I just want you to notice one thing. I'm not going to exegete the whole passage right now, but I just want you to notice one thing. God visits the iniquity, etc., etc., etc. Who is the active agent in that? God is the active agent, right? God is doing this. You know all those ministries that are out there meant to break the curse of the sins of the Father? Who are they fighting if they're breaking the curse? They are fighting the one who initiated it in the first place, who is God himself. If you're trying to break that curse, you're fighting God. Nothing could be more obvious from the text if people read the text. God visits, God visits, God visits the iniquity. Whatever it means, God's doing it. So you're not going to go through some Christian mumbo-jumbo and say the special prayer and have this incantation and wave the holy water and all this other superstitious stuff that so many people do to break the curses, binding the devil and casting out this, that, and the other thing to break the sins of the Father. God did that, not the devil. And if you want to deal with that, you got to deal with God. Now, I think it means something in particular. It doesn't mean what almost every single person I've ever heard talk about it mean. And I think there is some. It is challenging to some degree to understand what's going on because the phrase is repeated a number of places. But the Ezekiel 18 passage makes it very clear that children will never be punished for the specific sins of the father. The father sins, does the sin. The guilt for that sin doesn't pass on to the children. In fact, there's a whole chapter there, Ezekiel 18, in which God is basically chastising Israel for this belief expressed in this little slogan they have. The father eats sour grapes, the children's teeth are set on edge. You know what that means? You know when you eat something sour? Or you eat a lemon? Oh, it's happening right now. You know you get this funny weird thing in your mouth. Well, the proverb goes, the father eats the weird stuff, but the kids feel the funny thing in their mouth, and it's a little proverb, and it's a figure of speech. The idea is the father does the action, and the kids get the result is the point of that, and they use it with regards to sin. The father does a sin, the kids get it. And by the way, that carries all the way into the New Testament, even though it's dealt with there in Ezekiel. Even in the New Testament, the disciples are saying, why is this man sick? Is it because of his father's sins or because of his own sins? So they still had a misunderstanding there. The Bible does not teach that we suffer for the sins of the Father. That is, we are punished for them. Now, there are some, obviously, consequences. If the Father sins, there may be consequences that fall to the children, but that's not what the text is talking about. If your father's an alcoholic, maybe you'll be an alcoholic. If your father's an abuser, maybe you'll be an abuser. Yes, there's a cause and effect relationship, but that is not an example of God visiting the sins of the father on the children. It's something else entirely. I'll give you my quick take on what I think that is. Oh, we're almost to break, aren't we? I'll give you my very quick take, and then we'll take a break and come back to your calls on what I think is going on there. I think it's talking about Israel corporately, how they live corporately, when they sin, particularly with idolatry, which is the context of the initial time this concept is mentioned. Exodus 20 is the Ten Commandments. Second commandment, God is a jealous God who visits the iniquity of the fathers and the children of the third and fourth generation. If the fathers are idolaters, if the country is idolatrous, the whole country gets punished. And as they keep on doing that, the country keeps on getting punished. And if they change their ways, if they love God, then God will lift the punishment on the nation of Israel and then give blessings to thousands of generations. He says third and fourth generation punishment, thousands of generations benefit. It's a comparison in a poetic way to show that God's grace is so abundant. That's the point there. Basically, it's talking about what God's going to do to Israel if they screw up, that he's going to deal with them as a nation. Look out. Play by the rules. 1-800-227-5278. In the 714 area code, lines open there, 754-4150. I'm Greg Kokel.
Hi, this is Hugh Hewitt. Want to make a difference for a Christianity worth thinking about? Stand to Reason can help you do just that. STR trains Christians just like you to be effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Stand to Reason relies on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting in your area and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You will learn how to deliver a message that is accurately informed,
Develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a manner that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting STR Radio today. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800-2-REASON or send your gift to 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. Again, 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. And thank you for listening.
Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these three self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org.
This is the show your pastor warned you about.
Take out the papers and the trash. Or you don't get no spending cash. If you don't scrub that kitchen floor, you ain't gonna rock and roll no more. Yaggedy yak.
Don't talk back.
Just finish cleaning up your room.
Oh, gosh.
Let's see that dust fly with that broom.
All right, Greg Kokel here, our Stand to Reason.
Get all that garbage out of sight.
Yeah.
Oh, you don't go out Friday night.
Let's go to Danny here. I've been waiting for a while. Danny, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, Greg.
Sure.
I called you about a month ago. I lead a philosophy discussion group after work.
Okay.
The last month's topic, I wanted to talk about evidence for the soul.
Okay.
I called you to get some last-minute coaching tips. You gave me some great tips.
Good, thanks. How did it work out? Did I tell you to call back?
Yeah, you did. You told me to call you back, so that's what I'm doing, to give you feedback on it.
Super.
And also bring up some of the questions and challenges that the group had for me.
Okay, remind me, is this a Christian group or non-Christian group?
Oh, it's a non-Christian group.
Okay,
well,
good.
It's anybody who shows up.
Yeah, all right.
Catholics and have atheists show up.
Sure.
Show up. So,
sure.
And, you know, the premise, of course, is if there's evidence for a soul, as you know, there's so many implications on
of
basically
course.
Everything.
Yeah, and if the soul doesn't exist, Christianity's done for.
Right, right. And so we talked about everything.
That's right. It's one of the
evolution creation debate,
sure.
Abortion.
Yeah, because if the soul exists, you're going to have a hard time making sense of that with a Darwinian evolution, which is a materialistic process.
Exactly.
And then it has ramifications for, you know, what do we make of human beings, the abortion. It's not just the abortion debate, but any rights claims whatsoever. Are our rights intrinsic, inherent, transcendent, or are they simply positivistic rights assigned to us by the majority, which majority can remove those rights whenever they choose?
Right.
All of those have to do with, essentially, they hinge on this question about the do we have souls? Are we rational selves that bear the image of God and therefore have transcendent value or not?
Right, right. And we talked for over 2 hours. In fact, we had to cut it short because, unfortunately, I picked the wrong night. It was the last game of the Lakers and Pistons.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was a waste of time to break early for that one.
Yeah, exactly. But we had some good discussions. And mm-hmm. some of the questions that were brought up, one was what about being under general anesthesia? If your soul is separate from the body,
it's ontologically distinct, is what I mean, right? Okay.
Okay, but
then
how come you should be able to still think, but you're under general anesthesia, you have no idea what's going on. That was the question.
Okay. Well, here's something to keep in mind. Our view of the soul is that the soul is in a deep union with the body, such that even though they are ontologically distinct, you know what I mean by that?
Yeah.
They are different existants, if you will, such that you could survive in principle without your body. You are distinct from your body. It appears to be the case that they are in such a deep kind of unity that certainly the one affects the other. The soul affects the body affects the soul. Think of a human being locked in a car, all right? If the car doesn't run, and the only way that the human being can express his will is through the capability of the physicality of the car itself. So if the human being wants to go anywhere, he's got to turn the car on, step on the gas, and drive. You know, if he wants to communicate whatever, he's got to be able to, you know, speak through the speakers that go out from the car or something like that. Now, if there's something amiss with the car, you can see how that's going to affect the influence, the ability of the human being to do what the human being wants to do. Okay, that it doesn't – just because the car doesn't move, it doesn't mean that there's no human being in there. It just means that there maybe the car, the physical part, is not working. And so remember, this is an analogy here. The self is like the human being. The car is like the body. So on my view, it certainly is possible. And this is all you have to do to make this point, by the way, all you have to demonstrate – is that the soul can be in a relationship with the body such that the work of the soul could affect the soul affects the body. In other words, you think move hand, the body move, the hand moves, or the body affects the soul. Stick with pin, ow. Well, the sensation is felt in your soul. you can have and this is a psychosomatic illness, works that way, and all these other things. There is an effect that goes back and forth. And it may be the case that in the present state of affairs that the soul requires the body to work at an optimal level in order for the soul to express itself, so to speak. And so you can have a soul, for example, even though you're an embryo, because the body is not developed to the point where the soul can manifest itself in certain capabilities. And when you're under anesthesia, the body is put down, and so then the soul is, in a sense, sleeping. It's inactive because that which it needs to communicate is not available to it.
Right. You know, I brought up that example. In fact, a similar example. I just said that, you know, if your car isn't functioning well, you know, the driver may be fine. It's just not capable of driving. And then also I talked about even when you're sleeping, you don't even know you're awake sometimes. And then after I discussed that, they brought up, well, what about people who have, let's say, mental retardation, Down syndrome, the schizophrenics?
Well, it's the same thing, though.
Same issue. But the thing is, is their soul, for example, is their soul mentally retarded also? Can it not think, can it not make proper moral judgments and decisions and so on, or is it just the car is, if you will, wrecked and doesn't function and drive well?
Well, keep in mind here in our illustration, the car is all the visible functioning. The car is analogous to all the visible functioning of the soul.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't like, I know in the illustration you can think, well, I can sit in my car and have all kinds of thoughts but just not get those thoughts out.
Right.
And so that's like a mute person maybe who's got all kinds of thoughts but can't speak with his mouth. But the point of the illustration is to go further than that, and that everything that the person is able to do is analogous to the vehicle. So if the vehicle is injured, that's going to influence everything, all the soul's functioning. It isn't like somebody's just on the inside thinking but can't get out, like I'm Helen Keller or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to affect all the soul's functioning. If the brain is hampered in a certain way, genetically or otherwise, then it's going to influence the operation of the soul. Now, by the way, keep in mind we don't have to figure all of these things out to make our case.
Sure.
And these are totally fair questions to be raised.
Right.
But what you don't want to do is allow them to think, since you can't classify every single aspect or resolve every question, that they've somehow made their case that the soul doesn't exist.
Exactly.
All we have to demonstrate is that the soulish activities are not physical activities, to show that the soul and the body are distinct.
Right.
And unless they can show some other necessary problem, such that given certain things about science, it is not possible for the existence of the soul to coexist with the existence of the physical body, therefore everything's physical. But nothing like that is ever forthcoming. In the illustrations that they're offering, the questions that they're asking are not like that in any way, shape, or form.
Exactly.
And do they realize that? Do they realize that?
Oh, yeah. That's what you brought up last time in terms of for me to watch out for, and I brought it back to discussion. Yeah, sure, there are some conundrums that,
yeah,
you know, I can't give a great answer to, but let's focus back on what about the evidences, the solid evidences I gave you? And if you can refute those, and let's talk about those. And the group seemed to agree.
Great. So the key issue is identity. Is the are soulish activities identical with physical activities? Can they be reduced to something physical in some significant sense so that we don't need the brain? We don't need the appealing to the soul. The brain appeal to the brain is fine and kind of following simplicity and Occam's razor. There's no sense in multiplying all these other occult or hidden entities here to explain what's going on. The fact is, yeah, we do need it because we can't solve the problem with just physical description of the world. There's too much that's unexplained.
Mm-hmm.
And constant correlation, physical activity with mental activity, that's not identity. That can just be constant correlation. Every time – look, if you got a rope that's 5 feet long and you've got a blue ball on one end and a red ball on the other, every time you pull and you pull on the red ball, the blue ball is going to move.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every single – you pull the blue ball and the red – well, that's constant correlation. There may be even a causal relationship between the two, but it's not identity. The blue ball isn't the red ball. They are just – at that point, they are hooked together by something, this piece of rope, such that everything that one does influences what the other one does, but they're not the same thing.
Right.
They're distinct
right.
things. And that's what you have with a lot of the illustrations. You just have constant correlation of things like a little C fibers firing in the brain and certain experiences of the mind, etc. But
right. The next one, which is I think the biggie, is and obviously they didn't use epistemology and ontology, but the questions that were related to this were basically if you know the five different functions of the soul that we believe in, beliefs, sensations, desires, volitions, thoughts, and so on.
Yeah.
That would be the epistemological way we can get at understanding or having evidence for the soul. But then there, such as the embryo, obviously doesn't have those functions yet, and that would be an ontological.
When you're talking about how you and I can assess the problem and judge whether or not there is a soul, that would be a way that we can do that. And we think if conscient, sentient people have all of those qualities, therefore they must have a soulish existence. And you're saying that that embryos don't have those five qualities, and therefore they don't have access to that evidence to prove that they actually have a soul.
Right, and so that would be the challenge. And obviously, as a Christian, we believe we are ensouled. Upon conception, and of course we can get into the creation tradition debate,
mm-hmm.
but that's
right.
an in-house debate. But
I think embryos do have sensations at least fairly early on.
Okay,
obviously at a blastocyst stage, they don't have sensations and awarenesses.
Well,
but
we
they
can
do.
Even yeah, exactly. We can take it that far to the embryonic, stem cell debate and so on, and even early abortion and so on.
Well, I think the fair question. I'm sorry, I interrupted. Go ahead.
Okay.
What were you going to say?
With the challenge, it really wasn't a challenge, but then the question is, when do you have a soul? If you're a non-Christian, well, maybe we can do embryonic stem cell research because, hey, it's just an embryo, it's not
right.
a soul, and that would be, that's a biggie.
Okay, here's I can see that, a fair question, okay. As soon as, very early on, the embryo starts to have sensations. In order for it to experience sensations, it must be ensouled, okay? So we have some evidence quite early on that there is a soul there. Then the other question comes, does the soul come in at that point of time when the sensations are felt, or is the body developing to such a point that the soul can use the body to sense things? That's the other alternative. Okay. Now, even if we can't adjudicate that, maybe we just don't know. Okay. What's the default position? If you have a building and you're about to blow it up and you don't know if anybody's in there or not, you're just not sure.
Mm-hmm.
Do you hit the button and blow the thing up? Well, the answer is no. You, if you're not sure if there's a valuable human being inside the thing that's going to be destroyed, you don't destroy it. So even if I were to say, yes, at this point, you could argue that the question is moot whether or not the soul exists prior to sensory awareness. Since it's moot, that is, it's not, you're uncertain about it, it's debatable, whatever, then actually that's a good argument for not doing anything, giving the benefit of the doubt to the fact that there may be a bona fide, valuable human being there, a whole human being there, soul and all, even at the earliest stages of conception. Now, there's another way of arguing. So, worst case scenario, we still make our case, I think.
Right.
Another way to ask, and I'll just end on this because here's the end of the first hour, is that you've got, what is it that drives the growth of the individual, the human, to its particular end? And that's seems to be a soulish function. So without the soul, it's not going to even drive the development of the body. A lot to think about, Danny. Keep up the good work. Give us a call in a couple of weeks or months when you've got more to talk about your group. Appreciate your help. All right, end of hour number one. All set for hour number two. We got more callers coming up, and still you can get on 1-800-227-5278. We'll be back in just a minute with our second hour.
Tired of walking past that old car, truck, boat, or RV that is rusting or gathering dust in your garage or side yard? Is your neighbor ready to kill you because your car is so ugly? Donate your used vehicle to Stand to Reason today, and you can put that old clunker to work developing training materials that can build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us today at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR, and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. We'll even tow it if it won't start and help you with all of the paperwork. You'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car from Stand to Reason. So, transform your old vehicle into ministry impact to Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR. Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever. Don't wait. Call us today.
Tired of defending your faith with, "The Bible says so," "does too," or "I think it does"? Do you remove yourself from conversations with friends and coworkers about sensitive subjects like abortion and homosexuality? Stop being unprepared and call today for the latest issue of Solid Ground, the bi-monthly newsletter of Stand to Reason. This free publication is filled with practical information and useful tools to help you articulate your faith and have a biblically grounded understanding of subjects like same-sex marriage, evolution, stem cell research, and partial birth abortion. Don't be embarrassed or unprepared when you stand up as a Christian ambassador. Simply pick up the phone and call Stand to Reason today at 1-800-2-REASON. In each issue of Solid Ground, Greg Kogel teaches you how to represent your faith as an ambassador of Christ in a concise and attractive yet effective manner. Learn tactics tempered with wisdom that make your beliefs persuasive, not naive. So contact us today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Or visit us on the web at www.str.org. Ask for the latest copy of Solid Ground to be sent to you today. It's free when you call 1-800-2-REASON.
Hour number two on Stand to Reason with the every Sunday 3 to 5 here, Los Angeles time. For those calling on the World Wide Web or listening on the World Wide Web, you can call when we're live, 3 to 5 Sunday, Los Angeles time. Make the adjustments and give us a call. 1-800-227-5278. If you're in the 714 area code, 754-4150. Under the category, arguments are good. And they are, by the way. The reason they are is they help you to get to the truth. Now, for those who are concerned about what Paul tells Timothy, I think in 2 Timothy, about not arguing, he says, "The Lord's bondservant must not be quarrelsome." There's a difference between arguing and quarreling. Arguing is taking a position and giving reasons why you think the view is true. Quarreling is banging heads with people. We are to do the first, but not the second. Unfortunately, nowadays, there is precious little of the first, that is good argument, and much of the second, that is just a bunch of fighting. And that gets us nowhere. In fact, when I talk about tactics and defending the faith, when I teach on it, I really encourage people, do not draw a line in the sand. You don't want to draw a line in the sand. You don't want to say, here's where I am, there's where you are, you know, that's it, and bang, 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 and you're shooting at each other. You draw a line in the sand, and people have turf to defend, and that just makes their job more difficult. But it is increasingly difficult to find people who are willing to have a good old-fashioned argument and instead would rather either walk away or have a quarrel or do kind of a hit-and-run technique where they toss something out and then they turn on their heel and go. And that's what John Leo has talked about just recently in U.S. News & World Report in his piece, The Beauty of Argument. By the way, if you he's worth reading on a regular basis. I sure like John Leo a lot, and he writes, I guess, in just about every issue he has a short piece, and he deals principally with political correctness and those kinds of things, and he refers to that as he opens his piece. Speaking of an informal talk that he gave the other night that that got a very odd reaction, he was speaking at a dinner of 16 people, a cultural group in New York, talking about the sometimes demented culture of American universities with their repressive speech codes, stolen newspapers, canceled speakers, defunded Christian groups, and the distortion of the curriculum by powerful diversity bureaucracies, and, of course, the indoctrination of students starting with freshman orientation in introductory writing courses, and oftentimes that indoctrination has to do with homosexuality. So he's talking about this with a small group. It's a dinner party. Excuse me. And he's mentioning this. He says, nothing in my remarks would have come as a surprise to readers of this column, and it turned out that maybe two-thirds of the people at the dinner strongly agreed with my talk, but it shocked one man, a former university president of some note. Okay, now, so here is a dinner party and the short informal talk given by John Leo about problems. There is a dissenter. The dissenter is a former university president. So this guy's lettered. He's been in the academy. He knows ideas. He knows it, the academy is a place where there's diversity. After all, isn't that what we're after? Of ideas, allegedly, where we knock things around and we, you know, beat up bad ideas and promote good ones, and we learn how to, you know, work it out, figure out what is true. Isn't that the whole idea? So here's a university president. What was his response? He denounced my comments as quote, the most intellectually dishonest speech I have ever heard, close quote. All right, that's a good start, good for starters. Leo points out, I think he meant to say that he disagreed. Or maybe I thought he was, I was attacking his old university. All right, well, whatever. Okay, you throw your gauntlet into the arena. What's a gauntlet? It's a glove. You know, you throw the glove in there. That means you're in the game. I'm anteing up. Here we go. Except for there he went. Nobody knows what he thought because he just repeated his intellectually dishonest remark and left, closing the door quickly behind him. I call that hit and run. You don't want to engage. You don't care to find out the truth. Not interested in persuading, you're just ticked off, you fire something out, you turn on your heel, and you run. By the way, ladies and gentlemen, if this is your style, you're a coward. And so was this man. Leo continues, this will stick in my mind as a good example of what has happened to debate in this country, given a chance to speak his piece. He had a chance, right? The college president just got mad and got out. Well, if you disagree, let's know why. Lay it out there. In fact, this wasn't just a disagreement. This was a challenge against Mr. Leo's character. That's the most intellectually dishonest speech I have ever heard. Really, what do you mean by that? First question. Second, how did you come to that conclusion? Let's hear about it. We're open. We're adults. We're educated. We can handle it. Turns on his heel, and he walks out. Leo continues, in my remarks at the dinner, I talked about the birth of a no-debate style on many campuses. Isn't that amazing? This is exactly what he was talking about, and then the guy gives him a great example. When sensitivity and non-judgmentalism are the dominant virtues, raising arguments can be perilous. You never know which unauthorized campus opinion will turn out to be a sensitivity violation. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, those codes require that you toe the line or else you have a violation and you get punished. Leo continues, better to keep your head down. This is particularly true now that some speech codes explicitly say, watch this, that challenging another student's beliefs is forbidden. Welcome to the university. Can I have my money back? I better read that again. This is particularly true now that some speech codes explicitly say that challenging another student's beliefs is forbidden. No kidding. Of course, that doesn't apply if you're not politically correct, because those beliefs are challenged all the time. He continues, this is yet another perverse campus trend. Arguing is crucial to education. And that was my point at the beginning, wasn't it? Arguments are good. Why? Because arguments help you to figure out what's true, and it's real important to know what truth is or what is true because your life depends on it. You pick up a white pill. Is this aspirin or is this arsenic? What is the truth? You better know. Of course, if you're postmodern, there is no truth. You just figure, what did my culture define this pill to be, and take it. And if you die, that's just a function of your language. Leo continues, in his book, The Revolt of the Elites, the late Christopher Lash wrote that only in the course of argument do we come to understand what we know and what we still need to learn. We come to know our own minds only by explaining ourselves to others. You know, sometimes I do say this when we're training on tactics and the Columbo tactics, and one of the first question that we teach people to use with the Columbo tactic, and you know what it is if you've had the training, is what? What do you mean by that? You need clarification. You know, sometimes people can't answer that. They make an outlandish statement, and you say, what do you mean by that? After which follows, there, silence, just like that. They don't know what they mean by that. They've never thought about it. And here, Christopher Lash, quoted here in John Leo's article, says that one way we come to understand what we know and what we still need to learn is through argument. We come to know our own minds only by explaining ourselves to others. Great thing about having a radio show, I get to do all this thinking out loud with you. Helps me to know what I believe and what's good about it and what's bad about it as you call and argue with me. That's the way it works. If we wish to be engaged in serious argument, Lash explained, we must enter into another person's mental universe and put our own ideas at risk. Exactly. When a friend launches an argument and your rebuttal starts to sound tinny to your own ears, it shouldn't be that hard to figure out that something's wrong. Usually that you don't really agree with the words coming out of your own mouth. Leo finishes, arguing can rescue us from our own half-formed opinions. Boy, that's great. That is great. Had a discussion with some young earth Christians in North Carolina 2 days ago, had breakfast with them, and it wasn't really so much about the issue young earth, old earth. It was about how we go about dealing with this issue. And one of my responses to them is that you guys are satisfied too easily. You have problems with your views and you accept uncritically outlandish ways of solving those problems. Sometimes I want to ask, is that really satisfying to you? You know, the 6 day isn't 24-hour solar day. Doesn't appear to be. Why? Because Adam's got to name all the animals. Doesn't that count against your view? No, because Adam was unfallen. He could speak at the speed of light. Does that satisfy you? Is that all it takes to satisfy you? This outlandish idea that he's out there talking at the speed of light, which he's capable of doing because he's not fallen? I didn't know that our bodies would be capable of that kind of thing, and it's just sin that's slowing our tongues down. Sometimes we're too easily satisfied. By the way, it's on my side too, things that I think about. I got to check myself on this. I'm not saying that the young earth position is wrong. I'm just saying that, or the old is right or whatever. I'm just saying, look, procedurally, let's be a little bit more honest, have more intellectual integrity in dealing with these things. When our rebuttal starts to sound tinny, he writes, it shouldn't be that hard to figure out that something's wrong. Well, argument helps us to get there, and unfortunately in our culture, people have been taught to argue well, and we are discouraged from arguing properly in the church because every argument, every principal disputation about matters of facts is treated like a quarrel. Oh, let's not fight. Let's not cause division. I'm not causing division. I'm just disagreeing in a principled way, and here are my reasons. And anyway, you shouldn't be stopping disagreement like that. Want to fight about it? No, let's have an argument about that. We ought to. If you don't do it in the world, you don't do it in the church, how the heck is anybody going to figure out what the truth is? Well, the person who screams the loudest in the world or in the church, they win. Or who says their view first in the church. You say your view first, then nobody can disagree in a principled way because then they're starting an argument. They're starting a fight. They're causing the division. This is silly. Arguments are good, ought to be encouraged as long as they're principled. Or they're done on the right principles. All right, let's see. Let's go to Dave, and you're first for this hour, Dave. Welcome to the show.
How you doing?
Doing okay, buddy.
Well, speaking about argumentation, I was wondering what your take is on the fact that even though Michael Moore's film Fahrenheit 9/11 was panned by the liberal critics as being unfactual, that it's number one at the box office.
Well, it just got 8 million the first weekend. That's probably it for the rest of the month. I mean, it's 8 million for the weekend. What's it up against? 8 million is not that much for a weekend.
I thought it was 21 million.
Oh, I heard maybe 8 million was the opening day.
Yep.
Okay, well, 21 million. All right, yawn. I mean, it's 21 million divided by 10, that's $10 a ticket. That's 2.1 million tickets. All right, there's 2 million people who like Michael Moore. I mean, that's explainable. Now, if he makes 100 million in the next 6 weeks, then I think that'll tell something. But, you know, from what you just said, even the critics panned it, it's not going to make that much. I attribute this success to the resident pop. There's a resident portion of the population that absolutely hates George Bush. They may not like Michael Moore. Didn't he get booed at the last Academy Awards? Didn't he get booed or something at something like that?
There was something like that going on, but that was before he won with the Cannes Film Festival in this film.
Yeah, well, still, he was making his political deal. It isn't like he's the most loved creature there in Hollywood. But he's got a following, and ever since he did the thing about General Motors or whatever back 20 years ago, he's just has this following. And they showed up this weekend. So we'll see if it takes him any further.
I think it's interesting that even though the liberal critics are penning it as unfactual, the liberal press is crowing and saying it's going to be the all-time box office champion of all time and so forth.
Oh, that's silly. That's just silly.
So
I don't even plan to see it. You know why? I'm just going to get angry when I see that stuff. More and more, to be honest with you, Dave, I don't want to read the newspaper. I get the LA Times, and I know they lie. I know they lie. Okay? And they lie consistently, and they lie on the front page. They're in full campaign mode, and so you can expect that they're going to try to get as many votes for their side as possible. Of course, California's already, Democrat. I don't expect to ever win this state, so I don't care that much. But it bothers me because I think, I like the truth, and I think these guys – it's so obvious. When you read the headlines, you can see they're lying. You don't even have to know a lot to know that they're lying. Same thing with this guy. This guy's terrible, and I had totaled a Reconstructionist when it comes to history and bad attitude. I don't want to ruin my day by watching his movie.
Do you think there's anything to be said for society in this regard, how far we've gone, that it goes even more liberal than the liberal critics do?
Well, I think, of course, it's hard to tell now. It's just been 1 weekend and 20 million, so we'll see what happens after the next couple of days. Some goofy thing's going to come out and some cartoon movie and put him in the basement, I think. But I don't know. King Arthur's coming next week, right? So that's the end of Michael Moore. He's not going to be a number one after King. He won't be able to stand up against King Arthur.
Oh, and there's Clinton's book signing.
Oh, yeah. Well, see, all of these things are happening. It's going to be very interesting to see. I'm just watching from the sidelines how this election goes. There is so much going against Bush in all of the pop culture stuff, you know. And there's another documentary coming up in Pro Carry. That's a movie being made. You got this 9/11 business. You got President Clinton's book that's come out. Although I think I understand he's comported himself badly in a couple of national interviews. But in any event, who knows what's going to happen? I'm not going to get upset anymore about this stuff. It'll be interesting if the president carries the day in November. This will guarantee that we have one of the most conservative countries imaginable, because when everything's going against him, he can still get elected. The liberal. The machinery of liberalism is going at such full tilt, and all the money and everything. So we'll just see what happens. I don't know what's going to happen. Obviously, a lot of people hate Bush. They don't love Kerry. Mm-hmm. And we'll just see. You know, I think it's going to be a bad for liberty around the world, not just here in this country, if Bush does not get elected. But we'll see what happens. But I'm not going to lose any sleep about Michael Moore. He's not worth my $10 to the theater, to be honest with you. So,
okay.
All right, I appreciate the call, Dave. Marvin, you've been waiting for a while. Welcome to the show.
How you doing?
Hi, Marv.
Hi. I had a question about Paul, St. Paul.
Yeah, sure.
A friend of mine had told me that he had heard somewhere, he doesn't remember where, that the Apostle Paul at one time earlier, before, you know, he wrote the letters of the New Testament, had been married, and I had never heard of that. I don't know. Is there any truth to that?
Okay, here's two questions you ask him. What does he mean by that? In other words, of course, you got a fairly good idea of that. He means that he was married before he wrote the New Testament, and now he's not married, apparently. Uh-huh. And then how did he come to that conclusion? So I'd want to know the reason why he thinks Paul was married. Now, there's no evidence at all in the New Testament that he was married, first off. Okay, there's no evidence. In fact, he makes a reference once. Excuse me, in defending his own apostleship. Pardon me, I got a cold coming on here. That's why I'm snuffing a little bit.
Okay.
He said, doesn't he have the right to bring along a believing wife if he wants to? Now, the sense of that, it doesn't sound to me like he's got a wife, and there's no reference to his wife anywhere in any of his works. So most people conclude that at least at the time that he's the Apostle Paul, that he's not married. So what would be the evidence that he was married before that? And the evidence is – I'll tell you what the evidence is. The evidence is that he's a Pharisee, and all Pharisees were supposed to be married.
Okay.
But that's not always the case. It's just not true that all Pharisees are supposed to be married. There are exceptions to that. There was a kind of a tradition, but it certainly wasn't locked in – cast in concrete, so to speak. So
most Pharisees were married?
Most people were – yeah, but most people were married.
Okay.
Most Pharisees were – most people get married even today. Singleness is unusual.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, in the long term, but people are getting married a little later now. But singleness was unusual now. It's unusual then, and it was especially unusual for a Pharisee, apparently, but it wasn't required. So we have no reason to believe that he ever was married. It doesn't think that he was married before he became the Apostle Paul. There's no evidence that he was married while he was the Apostle Paul, so I have no reason to believe that he was married then or any time. Very simple. Alrighty.
Yeah. Okay, on the subject of marriage real quick. Though,
okay, you're going to have to hold on. Hold on just a minute, Marvin, because I got to go to break. Hold on, and I'll come back to you. We'll get another question there, and then we'll keep moving through the calls. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason.
Do you have an important decision to make in your life? Are you looking for God's guidance or leading before you move ahead with the decision you're currently faced with? Well, Greg's teaching on decision-making and the will of God, available on audio cassette or CD, takes you through the scriptures to provide the tools you need to make sound choices. After hearing Greg's teaching, you'll experience a deeper sense of relief and freedom in decision-making than you've ever known before. You'll understand how reading Scripture carefully makes a difference in many different issues, including making decisions. Decision-Making and the Will of God is available today from Stand to Reason in audio cassette or CD format. Extensive notes are included to help you with your study. Simply go to www.str.org or call the office at 800-2-REASON. And order Decision-Making and the Will of God today. You'll be glad you did.
Hi, friends. This is Scott Klusendorf. And every year in the United States, there are over 1.4 million abortions performed. If you're ready to defend the unborn, then I want to enroll you in a class taught by Greg Kokel and me. Stand to Reason's interactive Making Abortion Unthinkable will prepare you to enter any pro-life arena, from one-on-one discussions to a public debate, with full confidence that your case is solid and your appeal is just. From the comfort of your own home or church, this easy-to-follow, well-reasoned plug-and-play course gives you everything you need to train yourself or a group in the art of pro-life persuasion. Through videotapes, workbooks, role-playing, quizzes, and games, Making Abortion Unthinkable will give you the tools you need to, one, restore meaning to the word abortion through the use of graphic visual aids, two, it will help you simplify the abortion issue by focusing on one strategic question. Thirdly, it's going to give you the scientific evidence you need to make a sound, reasonable, and persuasive argument. And finally, you're going to be able to expose the four common flaws of pro-abortion rhetoric. If you're ready to take a stand against abortion, call Stand to Reason today at 800-2 and the word reason. That's 800-2 and the word reason, or visit us online at str.org.
Well, I saw the thing coming out of the sky. It had one long horn, one big eye. I commenced a shaking and I said, "Ooh-wee, it looks like a purple people eater to me." It was a one-eyed, one-horned, blind purple people eater.
I'm not sure the significance of this song for this portion of the show. Maybe because I'm hacking around in my throat because I got this weird thing happening here. Sitting on the couch last night, and then I sneezed. And you know, it's the sneeze. It's the feeling right after the sneeze when you think, you sneeze and you think, oh, wait a minute, that was not an ordinary sneeze. There's something else going on here. And sure enough, here it comes. So last night I got to bed and I was a little bit raspy in the throat, and this morning I felt better. Now it's getting worse again. Maybe I'm talking too much, but if you hear me sputtering and fussing, you know that's what's going on here. So back to the phones, and Marvin, are you back, Marv?
Yeah.
Yeah, you had another question about marriage. Since that was such a short one, we know the Apostle Paul wasn't married. No reason to believe that he was. So what's your follow-up question on marriage?
It's about 1 Corinthians 7:1.
Yes. It's not right for a man to touch a woman. Yeah.
And then the NASB says it's not good for a man to touch a woman, and then NIV says it's good for a man not to marry. I'm just wondering why it's translated different, and which one is the most is the more reason. More
well, if it's a, if it's look at here's a general rule to follow. If it's between the NASB, the New American Standard, and the NIV, the NASB is always the better translation. That's your basic thing.
Okay.
Because the New American Standard is a different type of translation. It's more, let's see if I get these terms right. You have, I can't remember. It's more like a direct correspondence than a, I forget these terms. But then there's this other kind that's more of a, to put it simply, it's more of a paraphrase. The NIV makes more judgments for you. It decides what it thinks it means, and then it throws in, it gives, adds a couple words or drops a few words or whatever to make it flow so more smoothly and takes out some of the ambiguity. But they're making the decisions for you.
Okay.
The text says it's not right to touch a woman. Now, what does it mean to touch a woman? It means it looks like what it means in the context is it means it's not right to be sexually active with a woman. That's what it means to touch her. It doesn't mean that it's not right to put your finger on the flesh of another female human being.
Yeah.
It's talking about touching sexually, and you follow by the rest of the passage. You know, it talks about this. But now concerning the things about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. But because of immoralities, let each man have his own wife and let each woman have her own husband. So he goes in to fulfill – husbands fulfill their duties to wife, likewise wives to husband, and the husband doesn't have – wife doesn't have authority over her own body. This is sex. He's talking about sex here. And so the question is you're not to be sexually involved, but since you have sexual desires, then get married. That's the place where you're supposed to have your sexual desires satisfied in marriage. Okay. That's the point.
All right. So would then the NIV version be wrong then?
Yes. If it says marry instead of touch.
Okay.
Now, because here's the reason it's wrong. It's because it's not the word. They shouldn't be making the decision for you. They should be letting you make the decision about what it means.
Okay.
And that's what bothers me about the NIV.
Yeah.
By the way, it was direct correspondence or dynamic equivalence. Dynamic equivalence is what they call that, and
that's what the
NIV is a dynamic equivalence. It is choosing a word that they think is equal to it, essentially for all intents and purposes. But they have to make some judgments, and I think they make too many of the judgments for you, and that's why I don't like the NIV.
One thing that the NIV has concerning the things you wrote about, it has a colon and then it says it is good for a man not to marry. One explanation I heard was that they had stated that to him, that it's good for a man not to marry, and then he responded by saying that, no, it is okay to marry.
Well, that's right. I think that's the right thing. Whether they put the colon or not in there, that's up to them, because there is no punctuation in the original. You have to make these judgments. But a colon suggests something. You know, it's not just a comma, whatever. It adds a little bit more meaning, and, you know, they have to make those judgments, okay? But I think what happened is the Corinthians wrote him a letter. We don't have that letter, but they wrote him a letter and asked him a question. There were I think, four letters to the Corinthians that Paul made. It wrote, we only have two of them that are part of the canon. But in any event, they had written him, and he says, okay, you are asking about marriage, all right? Well, look, it's not good for a man to be sexually involved with a woman, but if you want to have your sexual needs satisfied, then get married. That's part of what marriage entails.
Yeah.
He says, because of immoralities, let each man have his own wife. Instead of faltering here sexually, get married. That's the idea he's saying. But then he says there's some disadvantages to being married too, and that is you're going to divide your efforts. But there's disadvantages to being single, that you might be sexually frustrated even though you can give more time to the church. So maybe, you know, if you can have undistracted devotion, fine. If it's undevoted distraction, well, then you should get married. That's kind of the idea there.
All right.
Okay.
Right, cool. Thank you. One quick question. You mentioned a few weeks ago that you were going to appear on MTV to discuss gay marriage.
Yeah.
Did that already air, or has it not aired yet?
I can tell you, but then I'd have to kill you. It's a secret.
All right.
It hasn't been aired yet, but I can't tell you that.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Yeah, they make you sign a deal, and you know you can't talk about it, so I'm not going to talk about it.
Okay.
Just keep. I don't even know. We haven't gotten any notice yet. If and when anything like this, just purely conjecture here, might end up on the air, and we, again, conjecture, have the freedom to talk about it, then we will, of course, tell people. But who knows, because I don't even know if it actually even happened, because I'm not supposed to talk about it. So, okay, sorry about all the mystery, but that's just the way it is with those goofy people. All right. Thanks, Marvin. Let's go to Eric. Welcome to the show, Eric.
How you doing?
Okay.
They
got a scratchy throat.
Didn't you call it a word-for-word translation or a thought-for-thought translation?
Well, no translation is word-for-word. Okay. Messages can't – I mean, languages can't be translated that way. I mean, look, you got the White House and Casablanca. You know, you got the – you know, in most languages except for English, you've got the adjective comes after the noun. So you don't say house white. You say White House because there's an appropriate way to order them in the English language. So you can't just go word for word. Actually, some languages have words that we have no corresponding words for. So this is why they call it a strict correspondence, which is they're trying to correspond as much as they can to the words and get the right word there. And as opposed to dynamic equivalent, which is a little looser kind of thing. You know, you can't avoid making some judgment calls. Look at the word on air. Could be translated wife, or could be translated husband, or rather woman, wife or woman. So, is the woman involved in question in any text where the word on air is being used? Is she being viewed there as a mere woman, or is she being viewed as a wife? And you have to make a judgment in that circumstance. What's the right way to translate it? And there's no way around to making some of those kinds of judgments. I just think NIV types, dynamic equivalents. They make too many of these things, and they drop, you know, words and conjunctions and stuff like that, and it really drives me nutty, because sometimes I'm making a real important distinction based on precise words in the text to an audience, and they're looking around like, what's he reading from? I said, don't you have that word and in there? No. I said, what, are you reading the NIV? Yeah, because they dropped the word and, made a new sentence, you know, instead of conjoining the two. Independent clauses there with the word and, chi, which is in the Greek, they just drop it and make a new sentence. But the and ties the first to the second, you know, and so it indicates a contextual relationship there, and a lot of times NIV will drop that. So anyway, I'm just being picky. I mean, but if you're studying, you want to be picky.
Right.
What do you got? Your question is on something else, though, isn't it?
Yeah. My question, I've been dealing with a Calvinist friend for a while, a couple of years, and one of the things that he told me, he said that God foreordained all events to happen,
right,
so that it couldn't be otherwise. It could not be otherwise. And I just have a hard time with that. That, you know, and he told me the other day, he talked about a verse that says that God works all things
after the knowledge of his will. Yeah, okay. Well, there's a difference between ordaining and determining. Ordaining and determining.
Yeah, okay. He said basically he set them in motion so that they could not occur otherwise.
Well,
but oh, great, then God hates divorce, yet he causes them all?
Yeah, well, see, this is where I think some people are not as precise as they might be because they may not understand it, on the one hand. And secondly, I think the concepts are a little bit difficult to grasp anyway. There's a difference in my understanding between foreordination of things and the strict determinism, determining of things, okay? In either case, you can have a fixed set of things that are going to be a certain way, and it is due to God's involvement. But the source of what causes them to be the way they are is different. In strict determinism, God causes directly causes every particular thing to happen. So things are going to be the way they're going to be because God causes them to be that way, and consequently, God is responsible for everything. If God determined things in that sense, then he is, and there is evil in the world, then he is directly responsible for evil. Okay, if God ordains things, that means he has, I'm trying to think of the best way to put it, and there probably is a kind of official way of saying this, but the distinction is that he has affirmed a certain series of events, which events themselves may entail the free will decisions of some people. So God ordains the crucifixion of Jesus Christ as the means by which the world would be saved, yet at the same time, he ordains them in the context of free will actions that will be taken by people who, in taking those actions, will be held responsible for the actions they're taking. God's sovereignty is such, and this is what we mean by his will in this sense, that his sovereign plan even takes into consideration in the ordination the freedom, the sinful actions of other people, yet he is able to take those things and work them into a plan that he ordains to accomplish the purposes that he wants to accomplish, such that it will be this way, even though people are making free choices. One of the reasons it will be this way is because people are going to make those free choices. Now, they could have made other choices, but then God would have ordained a different plan.
Yeah, because I don't hold the idea that God saved those, you know, who he knew would come to him. You know, I don't know exactly how God made his choice or whatever, but
right.
I don't know. I hear so many arguments from a couple of Calvinist people I've talked to, and I just have a great deal of difficulty.
Yeah.
And one of the things is, well, then why are false teachers in so much hot water with
Yeah,
God?
I agree. Well, I think there's a legitimate distinction here between direct causation or determinism and foreordination. And one has a place for free will, the other one doesn't. And I think that some Calvinists have crossed the line. So in seeing God's sovereign purposes fulfilled, in their mind, the only way he could do it is if he causes every single thing to happen. If he does that, if he's the cause of every single thing to happen, well, then he's responsible for all of the evil in the world.
I would agree, and that's my point to them directly, and they just turn right around and say, no, you don't get it. He's not the cause.
Well, either he is the cause or he's not, and what they're going to have to do is make a distinction between foreordination and determinism. Now, having said that, though, I think it's very difficult to try to characterize how it is that God gets all of his things done, that he wants it exactly as he wants it, yet at the same time, people are exercising their free will choices. So, I mean, is he just really smart and so he's just one step ahead of everybody else? I think the Bible characterizes him as somehow more intensely involved in the enterprise than that. But how we cash this out, I think it's very difficult to do. So I'm Reformed. I'm Calvinist, particularly with regards to the salvation issue.
You're more of a thinking Calvinist than 99% of them.
Well, I don't know if that's a fair assessment, I mean, of them. Maybe it is of me. I don't know. But of other – I think a lot of them are thinking, but maybe a lot of them aren't as well. So – You know, some get into this and then they just jump in and they try not to be – they're not concerned about refined distinctions here that will help clarify some of these issues and not make them so problematic. But anyway, that's the best I can do here. Okay, Eric?
Thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate your call. Let's see. Clock. Okay, time for a break, right? Then we'll get to Larry on 1 Corinthians 10:13. Which is an issue I talked about last week, I think. And then we'll take your calls, if you'd like to call, 1-800-227-5278, open line there. And in Orange County, the 714 area code 754-4150. I'm Greg Kokel. Don't go away.
Hi, this is Hugh Hewitt. Want to make a difference for a Christianity worth thinking about? Stand to Reason can help you do just that. STR trains Christians just like you to be effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Stand to Reason relies on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting in your area and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You will learn how to deliver a message that is accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a manner that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting STR Radio today. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800-2-REASON or send your gift to 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. Again, 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. And thank you for listening.
Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these three self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed at how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800, the number 2, and the word REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org.
Listen, where do you get this nonsense?
Greg Kokel here. Clear Thinking Christianity, of course, and giving you something worth thinking about, since I think Christianity is worth thinking about, every Sunday, 3 until 5. And 1-800-227-5278 is my number. Let's go back to the phones. Larry, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Thanks. I remember you talking about 1 Corinthians 10:13.
Yes.
Last week, but there was a question I had.
Okay.
About that.
This is the passage where it says, "No temptation has overtaken you, but such as is common to man, and God is faithful, who will not allow us to allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will provide the way of escape also that you may be able to endure it."
Yeah, that's what I don't understand. You know, when eventually when we fall, when we sin, theoretically there's a way provided for escape, and
right.
I'm not sure how to understand that.
What would be the confusing part of it?
Well, why
not take it at face value, I guess?
Okay. Face value, there's a way to escape.
No temptation has overtaken you, but it's common to man. Okay, so all the kinds of temptations we're going to experience are normal, ordinary, common temptations. God's faithful. He won't allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able. With the temptation will provide the way of escape also. Have you read the context, by the way, chapter 10?
Probably. I just have the verse right.
Yeah, it's always good to look a little below and above and around and around.
I have done that before.
Okay, this is called Never Read a Bible Verse. What you have here is a comparison or a discussion about Moses and the Jews, and that they had all this. They were baptized into Moses in the cloud. They ate the same spiritual fruit. They drank the same spiritual drink. And nevertheless, with most of them, God was not well pleased, for they were laid low in the wilderness. God judged a lot of the Jews. And And then he says, don't be like them. Don't be idolaters, verse 7. Don't act immorally, verse 8. Don't let us try the Lord, verse 9. Don't grumble, as some did. And there's these consequences. Now, these are things that happened to him as an example. So don't do these things. Let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. Be alert, be careful. But don't give in to these things. And the reason you don't have to give in to these things is because God is giving you will give you a way to escape your temptation. Oh. That's verse 13. Therefore, he says, verse 14, flee idolatry. Okay? So he makes application. Here's the way to get out of idolatry. You run from it. So God's going to give you a means to escape it so that you will be able to endure it. Nobody could say, I guess, that, gee, it was just too big of a temptation. I'm not responsible. I was overcome.
Okay, like, so there's not like when you're tempted, there's somehow something there basically what he's saying is that the provision for escape is just to run from something.
Well, no, I think the application in this particular case, he makes one application, idolatry. You flee idolatry. And so he presumes that you're capable of fleeing it because God is giving you an ability, the means, the will provide the way of escape for the temptation so you can endure it, you know. If you get involved in the circumstance of temptation.
Normally we just fall. I mean, maybe not.
You fall to every temptation? You never walk away?
No, that's not true. But
okay, what about you?
When you do fall. I
mean. There's the liquor store over there. You're looking at this liquor store, okay? You could take a step and go into the liquor store, and then you can go pick up some magazine that you shouldn't be looking at in that liquor store. There's two steps right there.
Yeah.
You're standing in front of the liquor store, is it easier to say no to that when you're standing in front of the liquor store or when you're standing in front of the magazine rack? You tell me.
Yeah, no, I understand that, but that's more common sense. I mean, is that what he means?
No, you have a means. You have a means to have escaped that. That means you could have made the right decision at the first temptation. You fight the first temptation you have a first temptation to go into the store to look at the magazines, and once you're looking at them, you got another temptation to open, or you're gazing at the rack, and the second temptation is to open the magazine. It's easier to fight the first temptation than the second. So you can get yourself with bad decisions further and further in where you're locked into the behavior. You're going to do what you're bent on doing, but there was a means to escape that you did not take advantage of. And that was early on when the temptation wasn't that hard. You could have walked out away from that before you even walked into the store. It was not that hard to walk away from it. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I understand that. Maybe I was reading something more into this.
Yeah, I don't know. I've never had this sense where, I'm just about to do something that I'm not supposed to do, and then all of a sudden, kind of out of heaven, comes this rescue machine that sweeps me off my feet and carries me away and rescues me. I don't think that's what it's talking about there. In fact, we are enjoined in chapter 10 because of the bad example of Israel not to be like them, and we are told we have the ability to turn from that stuff. So this entails our decisions in turning from temptation. Do you see what I'm saying? It isn't like we're just going to be – somebody's going to grab us and pull us away. Now, every once in a while that happens. You know, we're bent on doing something that we shouldn't do. We're on our way, and mercifully, something happens that we're not in control of. Somebody that we know from church walks by on the sidewalk just before we go into the store, and all of a sudden, whoops, okay, guess that takes care of that, you know, kind of thing. And we get into conversation, we don't continue. That's God's sovereign intervention to rescue us from ourselves.
Right.
I think this is talking about something different.
Yeah, okay, well, What did you say about something different?
I think this is talking about something different.
Oh.
This is talking about us making decisions based on the resources that God gave us and that we have the resources. So we can't say, well, God, I wouldn't have done that if you'd have just brought somebody by to stop me.
Yeah.
So it's your fault. No, we've got the resources in ourselves and the Holy Spirit and whatever. So
okay.
Got to run, Larry.
All right.
I thank you for your call, and we want to get in a couple more calls before the end. Alan from Missouri, welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi, this is Alan. Hi, Greg.
Alan, where in Missouri are you from?
St. Louis.
All right. I sometimes broadcast there on a Lutheran station once a month about do an interview with those guys.
And do you know which one?
KFUO.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so what's on your mind today, Alan?
Actually, I had a couple questions, but if you've only got time for one.
We'll give it a shot.
Live.
We'll start and see where we go with it.
What do you think of the inductive method of Bible study?
I think it's pretty much the only method that works well. Inductive means that you let the text speak for itself, and if you want to find out what the text means, you find out by looking at everything around it. We were just talking about 1 Corinthians 10:13, and the way we answer the question of what does 13 means is by looking inductively, by looking at the context around it.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is if you don't study inductively, it's too easy to go astray. You want to draw your meaning from the details of the text is the idea there. By the way, that's the way we learn language. You want to know what a word means when you're growing up. These words start coming at you, and you begin to inductively in your environment, in the different occasions where the word comes up, you start to generalize the truth from the way the word is used in multiple examples or multiple circumstances. That's inductive as opposed to deductive. When you go from the general to the specific, that's inductive. And by the same token, when we're studying in the Scriptures, we want to see how a concept is used. We want to know, well, what does the Bible teach about prayer? Well, we can't just look at one verse and say that's the whole thing. We learn inductively by looking at the full range of things the Bible teaches about prayer. Instead of importing our own ideas, we let the Bible speak for itself. And I think that should be our standard way of studying.
And specifically, Kay Arthur's study guide?
She's first rate.
Good, okay.
Yeah, give her a full, clean bill of health. I don't know that I always agree with her theology, but her methodology is great.
Okay. Got time for another quick one?
Sure. Okay. That was painless.
Okay. What type of Bible teaching do you recommend for children? I have three. And my idea of raising I've been a Christian all my life.
Uh-huh.
Raised on the charismatic side of things.
Uh-huh.
Are
you still in the charismatic side of things?
No.
Okay.
No, and actually your tapes, especially the how to avoid becoming spiritually weird.
Oh, yeah.
And all of those.
Well, that doesn't always just apply to charismatics. I mean, I wasn't picking them out, but there is generally charismatics are more open to personal revelation from God, and I think that gets people in trouble. So,
yep.
So what are you thinking about giving to your kids?
I'm looking for something.
Oh.
I mean, I can walk them through, so I've begun to...
Well, you know what? I have a suggestion. First of all, I don't know for sure the best answer to this, okay? Because I don't have kids myself, so I haven't had to solve that one for myself. But I don't know what's wrong with just catechizing people the way they used to do in the past. Kids got catechized. I mean, if you think about the Lutheran Catechism or the Reformed Catechism, like the Westminster Shorter Catechism.
Mm-hmm.
You might just want to get one of those things. Now, might be some doctrinal issues that you disagree with, like Calvinism and election and that kind of stuff, but there's a lot of good stuff in it. It starts out with the first question, what is the chief aim of man? And it's to love God or know God and to glorify him forever. So you got – it starts out right where you should start out. You know, and what happens in these things is the kids are supposed to learn these and memorize them, whatever, but that's a good – it builds a good foundation from the bottom up. There is actually, if you can get the I have an edition of the Shorter Catechism, Westminster Shorter Catechism. It's more in a popular paperback size in which they have the statement from the catechism, and then it has a page of explanation about it, and it talks about it a little bit. And this might be a way of introducing some of those things to kids. So,
where do I find that?
Well, I'm not sure. I have to
just dig around.
You know, if you can send an email to Melinda at str.org or to str.org, just send an email to Stand to Reason.
Okay.
And ask for the detail about the shorter, or maybe it's the Heidelberg Catechism. Anyway, I got a popular version of it, and I can have her send back the email information to you. But I would go to Amazon first off and just put Heidelberg Catechism and the Westminster Catechism.
Okay.
And just do a search on both of those and see what you come up with. And if not, send me an email and I'll route that out and find it.
Okay.
I'll dig that out for you. All right. That's what I suggest at this point. I'm sure there's better things out there. I mean, there's other things that are really well geared for this, but I haven't gone through them myself. So there's another series of books by, let me see if I can get this guy, Anders, A-N-D-E-R-S, Max Anders. And they're good. They're a whole series of different books, you know, 10 weeks through the Bible kind of thing, or 50 lessons for 50 days on 50 things in the New Testament or something. But I like his stuff. And they're really geared for adults. But, you know, nowadays when you make stuff for adults, kids could probably understand them too because they're so simplistic. He does a nice job, and you might want to get a couple of his books and just look at them and see if you can adapt it because they are geared as curriculum.
Okay.
Max Anders.
Got it.
Okay, got to run. Let's see if we can get another caller in here. Thanks a lot for the call, Alan. And let's go to, Justin, welcome to the show.
Hey.
Hey. Ghost hunting, huh?
Yes, ghost hunting.
Oh, gosh.
We were up recently visiting my brother. And,
He's watching too many movies.
Well, I knew he was in this kind of little club, but we didn't kind of realize how deeply entrenched, I guess, he is in this sort of stuff.
Okay, so he's a Ghostbuster type.
He's a ghost hunter. He's in a club that goes, and the club goes, and they do investigations on the locations and houses and things like that. And I don't know if he's actually been on any, but I know that the club actively does this.
Yeah.
And they get together once a month, and they discuss what they found and what they, you know.
Yeah.
And I actually found out he was the librarian of their...
So you want to know, we're a little short on time, is you want to know what you can say to him and do, and maybe
right.
to just...
My wife kind of got into a discussion with him in the car, and she, unknowingly, I'm actually right now doing your ABC course. And
oh, good.
She unknowingly Columbo'd him.
Oh, good for her.
We didn't know the tactic, but she kind of asked him kind of what he thought. And she said, well, I don't understand. How do these people, who are these people? What are they doing?
Uh-huh.
Why are they still here?
Yeah.
You know, and he explained, and he has this whole view of how... you know, he thinks that people get a choice as to whether they want to go to heaven or they want to go to hell after they die.
Oh, it's their choice, huh?
Well, I know, and she said, well, I don't...
Who would choose to go to hell?
I mean, hell.
Yeah, exactly. Who would choose that? He probably thinks it's just a place where all the nasty guys go, and so you can kind of go to you can go to Vegas, or you can go to, you know, St. Mary's Cathedral or something, and, you know, it's like you choose which one you want, and all your buddies who are nastier, they're going to be out there gambling in Vegas kind of place. That's hell, you know, and you can hang out and party with your buddies there. That's more fun than sitting on clouds and drumming harps. But
he thought it was bad, but he just thought that some people just really one explanation he gave was a ghost story he knew of where a woman was just a really mean woman through her life, and she hated her sister, and her sister chose heaven, so she decided to choose.
Oh, yeah. Well, on Earth, okay. Well, it also presumes – how do you – like? I'm trying to think of what would be the best way to approach him. For one, you could say, you know, you just build some common ground. You could say, just tell him you believe in ghosts, although they're not – that is spirit beings. But you have no – but you don't think they're the ghosts of people who have died. And the reason is because the Bible says that human beings can't come back.
Right.
And this is in Deuteronomy. And then you don't pray to the dead. And, of course, you got Saul going to the Witch of Endor. And Samuel does come back once, but he says, hey, cut that out. In fact, it's big trouble for him when he does.
Right.
For Saul as a result of that. So, but there are spiritual beings. And so how do you know that you're not messing with something that's really nasty? When you have a credible spiritual tradition that's worth considering, that gives great warnings about this. Sorry, Justin, about the short shrift here we got at the end of the show. Sometimes that happens, but might probe him and just directly address him, saying, you know what, this could be really dangerous, and if Jesus was right about things, it is. And you ought to be thinking twice about some of this stuff. So give it a shot and maybe call again and tell me how you've progressed. That's the end of our show, friends, and I'll be back in 2 weeks, or rather next week, with more of the same, and I look forward to talking to you then. In the meantime, be a good ambassador, all right? Knowledge, wisdom, character. Knowledge, an accurately informed mind, wisdom, an artful method, and character, an attractive manner, as you're an agent of change for the cause of Christ. Go out there and give them heaven, friends. Bye-bye now.
Tired of walking past that old car, truck, boat, or RV that is rusting or gathering dust in your garage or side yard? Is your neighbor ready to kill you because your car is so ugly? Donate your used vehicle to Stand to Reason today, and you can put that old clunker to work developing training materials that can build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us today at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR, and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. We'll even tow it if it won't start and help you with all of the paperwork. You'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car from Stand to Reason. So, transform your old vehicle into ministry impact to Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR. Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever. Don't wait. Call us today.
Tired of defending your faith with "the Bible says so," "does too," or "I think it does"? Do you remove yourself from conversations with friends and coworkers about sensitive subjects like abortion and homosexuality? Stop being unprepared and call today for the latest issue of Solid Ground, the bi-monthly newsletter of Stand to Reason. This free publication is filled with practical information and useful tools to help you articulate your faith and have a biblically grounded understanding of subjects like same-sex marriage, evolution, stem cell research, and partial birth abortion. Don't be embarrassed or unprepared when you stand up as a Christian ambassador. Simply pick up the phone and call Stand to Reason today at 1-800-2-REASON. In each issue of Solid Ground, Greg Kogel teaches you how to represent your faith as an ambassador of Christ in a concise and attractive yet effective manner. Learn tactics tempered with wisdom that make your beliefs persuasive, not naive. So contact us today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Or visit us on the web at www.str.org. Ask for the latest copy of Solid Ground to be sent to you today. It's free when you call 1-800-2-REASON.